Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. Today on the pod, we're going to talk about former CIA director John Brennan losing his security clearance, rather Trump revoking his security clearance, and what that sort of means in a larger context. We're also going to talk about Alex Jones, as much as I would love to keep his name out of my mouth. I think there is an interesting shift in the free speech debate here that I think is worth talking about. And then we're also going to talk about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her continued lies from the podium and basically how she and Trump and this entire administration are manipulating facts and figures to further gaslight us as a nation. So I also had the pleasure of speaking to Janae Phillips, who is the director of learning and education at the Harry Potter Alliance. I was so excited about this interview. It is, you know, such a nerdy thing, and it's really great. But we talk about how fandom and how pop culture can really bring people into activism and politics. So it's a really fantastic interview. And like I said, it's so cool to be able to interview these amazing women doing amazing things in the political space across all sorts of fields. So everything from geek culture to running for Congress. And it is just so amazing. So we have a lot to get to today. You're no longer in studio, which is sad.
Yeah. It's fun to be back in Berkeley. So I miss being in studio, but it's fun to be back in Berkeley. I just had a meeting with a bunch of grad students. So I'm excited for the school year to start. The best thing I did since I got back was reorganize my makeup vanity. And I feel ready for whatever life gives me. It was so easy to put on my makeup today. And I was just like, yes.
So this is perfect.
It's been a good few days.
I actually want to start with some feedback. We haven't been doing a lot of feedback recently, but there's been some important ones. And the first one was actually a tweet by Lazenby's Knees. And they said, quote, "How can Varsha say that there are no market solutions to anything while still maintaining Hellbent's pro-capitalist ideology?" So Varsha, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. So there are market-based solutions to things. I shouldn't have been so glib about that. Like, Obamacare is a market-based solution to the problem of healthcare, but as we all know, it's not perfect. I think the reason I said that is there are no pure market-based solutions to anything. Like, Hellbent and I am not like a libertarian. I don't believe that everything can be relegated to the market because that's going to result in chaos. I believe in government intervention. So obviously, while we are pro-capitalist, or why I am pro-capitalist in the sense that I agree that people should have access to private property, there should be markets, people should be able to sell and buy things they want, I also believe in a healthy amount of government regulation when it comes to certain inefficiencies in market-based solutions. An example of an inefficiency is healthcare.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. And I feel like on the show, we definitely lean towards a more pro-capitalist ideology because, like you said, Varsha, I think that private marketplace and competition within those marketplaces is a good thing. And so the government coming in and regulating isn't necessarily, you know, there's a balance there. It's always a balance.
There is a balance. And I think my views on government regulation is just informed by how it's worked in the past and how it hasn't worked, right? And it's also informed by, you know, there's this trend going on in right-wing publications talking about how, you know, Scandinavian countries or European countries aren't really socialists, they're social democracies. And I'm like, yes, right, they are very capitalist, but they're also very socialist in how they regulate. That is what I mean by a capitalist market that's actually like regulated to weed out inefficiencies and to protect people. So I agree that I shouldn't have been so glib, but I do think a healthy amount of government regulation is important.
So we have a second piece of feedback from Jocelyn, who emailed us. And it's kind of long, but I think it's a really important discussion to have. So I'm going to read the whole thing. So stick with me here. "Hello, lovely folks at Hellbent. I have a couple of reasons for emailing. The first is to agree with everyone who has said that Devin and Varsha have amazing chemistry. I love hearing the two of you do the podcast together. The banter is wonderful, the back and forth is fast and clever, and the helping each other get pissed off and also get practical when the time comes. It's all great."
Yay!
I know, I love that. Warms my cold feminist heart. "The second is a couple of comments recently that I want to bring up as something for you to be aware of going forward. Last Monday's episode, I think, around the 18-minute mark, there was a comment about Stephen Miller wanting to implement a policy of white supremacy. Then, in this most recent episode, Unite the Right Rally 2, the rallying, around the 22-minute mark, there was quote, at times whiteness has included Jewish people and not at other times. Since I know you are deliberate about how you talk about these things, a fact which I really, really appreciate, I want to talk about why I personally would have phrased things differently. I'll start with the most recent episode, since this is pretty clear cut. There are absolutely Jews that benefit from white privilege on a daily basis, even if it's not always the same way that other white people do, myself included. However, there are a lot of Jews who never benefit from white privilege simply because they are, in no circumstances, considered white. Many people in my congregation would fit into this category, and many, I think it's over half, of the Jews in Israel would be considered people of color in the United States. Assuming that American Jews are white isn't just a problem when people unfamiliar with Judaism talk about Jews. There's also a lot of work being done within Jewish communities to combat norms that exclude Jews who aren't Ashkenazi, also not a synonym for looking white, as well as those from all racial backgrounds. So that's something to be aware of when talking about Jewish people as a group. There are plenty of us who benefit from white privilege on the daily, and there are plenty of us who are still not and unlikely to ever be considered white. And I just want to stop for a second and say that is such a great point. And making a monolith out of American Jews or Jews in general is absolutely something that happens a lot. And it's definitely wrong. And not fair. And you're absolutely
Think it should have really been more in context. As in, like, at certain times, certain groups of people who are Jewish have benefited from whiteness only because white people have accepted them, though. This is not because Jewish people have inherently, like, bought into this because they want to. This is like a system. And I just think at certain times, certain groups of people within certain ethnicities have fit into that. And so I take that point to heart. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Me too. And we definitely were not precise in that language. So she goes on. As for Stephen Miller, as much as I would love to completely disown him, he is Jewish. Saying that a Jewish person is working to implement a policy of white supremacy, I think that was the phrasing, may not always be untrue, but I suggest using plenty of caution when making that assertion. I'd certainly want to hear more about Miller's plan for what his racist policies mean for Jewish people, regardless of skin color, before making a statement that dramatic. I haven't been able to find anything that suggests he's plotting his own eventual downfall, but I know the two of you do a lot of research, and anyway, with this administration, who the heck even knows? I wasn't going to email about that on its own, but I figured I'd add it here as part of a larger conversation. So I really loved this feedback, and it was so many great points, and I really appreciate being held accountable for, you know, when we don't use precise language, when we kind of fail to understand the larger, you know, some of these nuances in especially something like white supremacy, which is so complicated and can be filled with so much nuance. So I just want to say thank you to Jocelyn for taking the time to email us and to correct some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, I know that Stephen Miller is Jewish, and I agree with Jocelyn's point that it's hard to label him as, like, constructing a system of white supremacy when he is affected by the system. I guess that's where it comes in, is you just have to look at his actions, maybe not his words, or you have to look at, like, the whole person. And I think the whole person since January 20th, 2017, it's difficult to see him as anything other than anti-immigrant. And that's just a personal view. And I think people can disagree with that. Right. It's just that is what he has espoused, and that is what he has espoused publicly. And it's frustrating. And I agree with Jocelyn that it's difficult to find the right language to describe that.
Yeah, it is. It's hard. And it's weird. And it might be more precise to say that he's more anti-immigrant and immigration than, you know, committed to a, you know, full white supremacy. But I do think that that is the result, regardless of intent. So that's just my thought on it. Again, it's one of those nuanced things that deserves more time to be thought through. So again, thank you so much for getting in touch with us. Okay, Varsha, so the first thing I want to talk about is former CIA Director John Brennan. Trump revoked his security clearance. And I do want to make it clear that John Brennan's security clearance, it's generally a courtesy that high-ranking officials who've left office retain their security clearances, and not for personal reasons. It's not like some prize it's not some door prize you get. It's so they can actually help, and the government can, and current administrations can benefit from the knowledge that person had and still has. And so without a security clearance, he is unable to, you know, join in think tanks or other groups that are helping the government solve current problems. So I just want to start with that. But can you tell us a little bit about this story and what's going on?
Yeah. So yesterday, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, during the press briefing, begins with this long statement of over like 500 words describing John Brennan, the former CIA director's, his frenzied commentary, his erratic conduct and behavior, and says these were reasons that Trump, because it's a statement from Trump that she's reading, removed his clearance. But it's clear through this statement that this was a personal, like, political decision to remove his clearance as if to punish him for him speaking out against the Trump administration. And she also announced that Trump is evaluating security clearance removal for others, including James Clapper, James Comey, Michael Hayden, Sally Yates, Susan Rice, Andrew McCabe, and Peter Strzok, and Lisa Page.
Which is like a who's who's list of who Trump is pissed off at and tweeting about at 3 a.m.
Yeah. It's very frustrating that Trump and Sarah Huckabee Sanders think that this quote-unquote frenzied commentary is reason enough to revoke security clearance, because if that was reason enough, then, you know, one would be like, why does Jared Kushner have a security clearance?
I was just going to say, let's remember that the Kush has a fucking security clearance that was given to him by Trump, even though he didn't go yeah. through the proper channels. So,
I mean, I think lying on your SF-86 and trying to meet with the Russians before inauguration can, like, you know, equates erratic conduct and behavior. So it was just surreal watching Sarah Sanders, like, read that statement. One, because it was clear, like, Trump did not write that, because if Trump wrote that, it would have been much more petty. It was already pretty petty. But I think while the taking away of a security clearance isn't like a constitutional, like, violation in itself, I think the reason behind it is pretty clear. And I think the reason behind it is, in my opinion, like, an impeachable offense. Because what he's doing, he is trying, President Trump is trying to, like, control and punish people who speak out against him. And John Brennan has been very, very vocal on Twitter. So even the ACLU was pretty critical of this move, even though they've been critical of John Brennan in the past because of his role as CIA director and, you know, CIA's relationship with torture. They were pretty clear that this is pretty egregious in what the Trump administration has done. And it's just a part of a pattern, because yesterday and across the country, a bunch of newspapers released editorials about Trump's attacks on the free press, over 350 papers. And I don't remember any other time during a presidential administration the press has had to say, hey, we're here. We should not be called enemy of the people. And Trump continued to do that. And today Trump attacked the Boston Globe for, like, setting up this chain of newspaper editorials, which is just bananas. We've just gotten so used to Donald Trump attacking the media and attacking individuals' right to free press, such as, you know, NFL players kneeling during the national anthem to protest police violence, such as anyone saying anything critical of the president. Like, we've seen it as so normal that even this revoking of the security clearance is seen as just, oh, haha, what a kooky thing Donald Trump did.
This goes to the larger problem of Democratic backsliding and normalizing and moving these goalposts so far that this doesn't seem completely fucking bananas, because this is punishing a political opponent, right? And it's not someone he ran against or that kind of political opponent. But I mean, Brennan on Twitter, in response to this, said, quote, "This action is part of a broader effort by Mr. Trump to suppress freedom of speech and punish critics. It should gravely worry all Americans, including intelligence professionals, about the cost of speaking out. My principles are worth far more than clearances. I will not relent," which is a strong statement. But again, this goes to a retaliatory action. And like I said, the list of people he's considering removing security clearances from is basically all of the people that have pissed him off or that have stood up to him or that have spoken out against him. And again, a security clearance is not a door prize and it's a courtesy. But at the same time, it's not what he's taking away. It's that he's doing it.
Yeah, and it's why he's doing it. And it's what he thinks he can achieve by doing it. Also, an interesting tidbit was the initial announcement was actually dated a month before yesterday. So they've been mulling over this decision for a month now, and clearly they're releasing it now because of a certain former White House staffer who's talking about Donald Trump. And so I'm not a big proponent of the whole "this is a distraction" narrative, but this is clearly a distraction.
Well, and also, if you know, they've been pondering this for a month, yeah, it does beg the question, why now? And also, you know, saying these frenzied comments, a lot of these comments have come more recently than a month ago. So again, this really depends on the why, the intent is really at question here. And so I also want to talk about, again, this is going to sound really unrelated, but follow me here for a second. So recently, Alex Jones, who is a piece of shit, not a dickwad, he has a radio show, a talk show, and a whole bunch of other media I don't know or care. And he's infamous for his InfoWars and conspiracy theories. I mean, he's literally the one that started Pizzagate and the one who thinks that the Sandy Hook shooting never happened. I mean, it's disgusting. He recently had his content removed from major distribution networks like Apple and Spotify and YouTube, as well as Facebook and all the other kind of major media distribution and social media platforms. And he like freaked the hell out. I saw this video of him just like yelling, like having temper tantrum doesn't even begin to describe it.
Yeah, it was pretty frightening, actually, because I don't watch his videos, so I don't actually know what he says on a daily basis. And watching that was just like, people watch this every day? It was very unnerving.
Yeah, it was very unnerving. So there was this little tiny story that came out. Alex Jones' flagship pirate radio station has been taken off the air. Liberty Radio is what it's called. And it's been embroiled in all sorts of FCC legal issues, finally shut down. So it really goes to this free speech, you're silencing free speech. And it's like, okay, first of all, I'm going to say this until I'm blue in the fucking face. Free speech only applies to the government restricting what you say. Also, free speech is not an absolute right. And the Supreme Court has litigated this over and over and over.
Yeah. If the FCC finds that your radio station is operating illegally or has some violations, they're allowed to shut down the radio station. Like that's what they regulate.
And as for these other platforms, you know, saying like, oh,
they're private companies.
They're private fucking companies. They can do whatever the fuck they want, right?
And their terms of service isn't like the United States Constitution. Right. It's not the First Amendment. Their terms of service is their own terms of service. And so this is why Twitter and Jack Dorsey have been really weak on Alex Jones, while other companies have been really strong on him. Like Twitter's response to Alex Jones is so weird. They're just like, we want an open like platform of ideas, not just one idea. And everyone is like, his ideas are going to get people killed.
Bite me, Jack Dorsey. Bite me. And yeah, so yeah, I did want to speak to that. So on Twitter, I guess Alex Jones and one of his associated accounts have been suspended for 7 days. But this also just speaks to a larger pattern of Twitter not giving a fuck and having these weak ass responses to serious problems and then hoping that it all goes away. Because Twitter seems to be like the lone standout here who hasn't banned Alex Jones outright, the impact of their non-decision is mitigated by the fact that YouTube is refusing to host his videos and Apple won't host his podcast or distribute his podcast. And I wanted to talk about this in relation to the Brennan story because it goes directly to the concept of the First Amendment and free speech. Because the difference is that Trump weaponizing something, even if it's a security clearance, which again, I'll say it again, is a privilege, is a whatever. Trump weaponizing something like that is a form of the government attempting to control a person's speech. They're not arresting him, but we've already talked about Democratic backsliding and how the goalposts have shifted and this is normalized. Then maybe it's like, oh, well, yeah, why not arrest him, right? And the other, the Alex Jones story, is a case of private companies refusing to do business with a fucking racist, sexist conspiracy theorist. That's the difference here. And that's why I wanted to highlight both of these stories. We talk about the First Amendment so much and the importance of news and media and the Fourth Estate. And I think that side by side, these seem like very different stories, but they really go to the heart of what the First Amendment is.
Exactly.
I also, lastly, would like to talk about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and the recent statements she made in response to Black unemployment. Varsha, can you tell us what she said?
Yeah. So during her briefing, basically somebody asked, can you guarantee Trump has never said the N-word? Or can you guarantee Trump is not a racist? Like they asked about this Omarosa tape and the notion that Trump may have said the N-word, which he probably has. And Sarah Sanders responded, "The president, since he took office in the year and a half he's been here, has created 700,000 new jobs for African Americans."
Which, and, like, you didn't answer the fucking question. We all noticed. See you, Sarah Sanders.
And then she goes on and says, "When President Obama left after 8 years in office, he had only created 800 or 195,000 jobs for African Americans." Which, that doesn't make sense. 800 jobs or 195,000 jobs? 800,000 jobs? I don't know. And then she says, "President Trump in his first year and a half has already tripled what President Obama has done in 8 years." That's not correct. That is not correct.
Right. And she was intentionally manipulating data. And her non-apology basically said, "I misspoke. I mixed up my figures." But I am certain that it was an intentional misrepresentation of the facts. She was intentionally misrepresenting these facts. Basically, what she was doing is she was comparing Trump's first 20 months in office to Obama's first 20 months in office and trying to say that those 20 months were all the jobs that were created in 8 years. And so that was like, oh, well, I just misspoke and I misunderstood the data, which, fuck you, Sarah Sanders.
You're the press secretary. Your job is to have a proper message for the White House. You can't just misspeak. Like, I think that's what's so frustrating about Sean Spicer and Sarah Sanders is that they think that they can misspeak and then pretend it's never happened. Like, remember when Sean Spicer totally mangled the history of the Holocaust and it was just very weird and it was very offensive to a lot of Jewish people? Like, he just said the next day, like, he apologized and like he misspoke, but like it wasn't okay. It's not okay.
Right. And the thing is she didn't misspeak. And then by saying she misspoke, again, it's this like gaslighting mess where we're expected to believe that these are good faith mistakes when in fact they are intentional manipulation. And the other problem is that the way job data and unemployment rates are tracked for a presidency is their stats begin the day that they're elected, not when they're inaugurated.
Yeah.
So President Obama's stats, like job stats on Black unemployment specifically in this case, were actually brought down by the
recession at the end of Bush's
recession and right at the end of Bush's term. And Trump's are being bolstered by the prosperity at the end of Obama's term. So it's not even a fair comparison. It's not even apples to oranges. It's apples to a fucking rock. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Also, it really just emphasizes this transactional nature the Trump White House seems to have with like people of color, but also just government. They think because they've done so well for like Black employment, that means like Black people owe them something and can never think of them as racist. It's your job to like make sure people have jobs. That's you work in the government. That's your job. You care about the job numbers.
This is a preferred talking point. And it's so obvious because, again, in response to this question about Trump saying the N-word and his language and the way that he speaks about Black people in general, the response was this, but look over here. Look at, you know, in response to Trump is a racist, they say, look at Black unemployment. Da 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 da. Like, it is their favorite talking point. Again, when I went to the Dinesh D'Souza mess, I asked a lot of the people on the red carpet, if you will, about this. And they all said, all of them said, Black unemployment is at record highs. And I'm like, that you didn't answer my question, even a little bit.
Also, they can't even take it one step further to explain what exactly Trump has done for Black unemployment. Like, what has he done? Existed? Like, if all he's done is exist, these numbers are largely credited to Barack Obama's presidency. Like, I understand that we are in the second year of Trump's presidency and now his economy is his alone. It's no longer Obama's economy, but there's still a piece of it that's Obama's economy, right?
Right. And again, then if he hasn't done anything except exist, you could make the argument that anybody in the presidency would see these same results. Obviously, that's not true. And that's a very difficult sort of argument to spin out. But what I'm saying, like, to your point, Varsha, he hasn't done anything specific about it. He's just using it to bolster his credibility, I guess, even though it doesn't even directly go to his credibility. And this also really speaks to, you know, we mentioned very briefly, and we haven't talked about it in depth on the show, but Omarosa, who is a Black woman who was on The Apprentice and she worked as a senior aide in the Trump White House, has just come out with a book. And she also has recordings of her and Trump and her and
John Kelly
about her time in office. And she was offered hush money and you know, she was fired in the situation room. Like, All of these ridiculous things. And in response, Trump says, this is what happens when you give lowlifes a chance, and that she is a dog. So Trump called a black woman who was a senior official in his White House a dog.
And he's called Maxine Waters has low IQ. He's called Frederica Wilson, like, I think stupid as well. So it's pretty obvious he only attacks women and people of color. And it's pretty, he's done the same thing with LeBron James and Don Lemon. Like, it's pretty obvious he's racist. So we don't need a tape of the N-word. But what was even more galling was the response to that question. So like somebody asked Sarah Sanders, why did Trump call Omarosa a dog? Isn't that like racist? Is that okay? And she was like, he's an equal opportunity attacker. And I was like, that doesn't make him look better. Like, just because he yells at white people too doesn't mean he's also not a racist.
Yeah, that doesn't make it, just doesn't make it fucking better. That's like when stand-up comedians are like, I'm an equal opportunity like
mocker.
Like, yeah, mocker. Yeah, or I'm an equal opportunity asshole. And I'm like, that still makes you an asshole.
Yeah.
It's not better. I also want to point out, and this is not the most important thing about the story. The most important thing is the fact that black women piss Trump off and he doesn't even attempt to hide his racist language. It's not even a dog whistle. His like sexist, racist like word vomit. But I also want to say, he said, when you give someone a break and give them a job as a senior aide in a white, no, that is not giving someone a break. Are you out of your fucking mind? Like, giving someone a break is like
letting them take your parking spot, right? Like, giving them $180,000 exactly. a year job isn't giving someone a break. Also, it doesn't really reflect well on you that you fired this woman four times or three times during Celebrity Apprentice or whatever, or three or four times, and then hired her again and then fired her. But now you're saying, oh, I hired her for the most important like job or the most important office in the world, but she's crazy and don't listen to her.
It basically proves that Trump was looking to strengthen his credibility and his reputation by hiring a black woman. That's all he wanted. That's all he wanted out of her. And now that she's speaking out, he's not just turned on her, but just revealed himself and revealed his intent. He, like we've said a couple of times in the last couple of weeks, he gave away the fucking game, right? He said what you're not supposed to say. And I don't understand how he keeps getting away with it. I mean, I do understand how he keeps getting away with it. But I feel like, again, this goes back to Democratic backsliding. We're not holding him accountable for the things that he's saying. And we're letting his fucking press secretary stand at the podium, lie to the American people, manipulate data and statistics. And we just go along like it's any other fucking Tuesday. And it's not.
It's so nauseating. Because it's happening so fast. And so I don't really have time to process it. So at certain times of the day when I like read the news, I feel nauseated because I'm just like, there is so much stuff I didn't have a chance to be angry about that I'm angry about, but there's all this new stuff I'm angry about. And so you miss like the forest for the trees sometimes, and that gives you a weird feeling. But this is the forest here. The forest here is that Trump doesn't like free speech. Trump doesn't like when people challenge him, especially people of color. And when he doesn't like it, he's going to try to use a presidency to his own ends, which is not good, not democratic.
This is not only Trump being a racist, sexist, disgusting pile of sentient garbage in an ill-fitting suit, but this is also him fucking with our democracy. And it is not okay.
It's not good.
Our guest today is Janae Phillips. She is the Director of Leadership and Education at the Harry Potter Alliance. We are so lucky to have her. So Janae, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I want to talk to you about the Harry Potter Alliance. And this is a group that I learned about at Comic-Con this year. So can you tell us what the Harry Potter Alliance is?
Absolutely. So we like to say we turn fans into heroes. We are a international 501c3 nonprofit. And what we do is we use parallels between real world issues and the fandoms and stories that we all know and love to help make those issues more accessible and more fun for people to participate in so that we can get more folks working on activism and kind of serving as a Dumbledore's army for the real world.
I love that. I love that. So do you focus exclusively on Harry Potter?
We don't, actually. So obviously, Harry Potter is our roots. We were founded in 2005, so kind of at the peak of Harry Potter fandom. But we have done international campaigns with the Hunger Games. We did an economic inequality campaign with the Hunger Games. We did a campaign called Superman is an Immigrant, because technically Superman is undocumented. And we also have a bunch of curriculum and toolkits available for a wide range of fandoms so that people can use the same concept and apply it to kind of whatever they're into.
So how do you kind of deploy your turning fans into heroes? Is it just like a digital community? Is it an in-person community? Like how have you created this space?
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. So our big goal is to make this stuff more accessible, right? So we've kind of, to that end, created a model where you can participate kind of however you want to. So we are an active campaigning organization. So we have folks participating kind of as individuals around the world, and they can follow our campaign updates and participate in actions kind of as we're sending out action alerts. And then we also have a chapters program, and our chapters are based in 38 countries around the world. There are about 250 of them. And those are all ages, all experience levels. We literally have folks from elementary schoolers to retirees in the program, can be based in anywhere they want to be based. And they are both kind of enacting the campaigns that we're doing on the ground, and they're also coming up with their own projects and campaigns based on the needs of their community using the same what we call fan activism concept.
What kind of actions or initiatives do you take as the Harry Potter Alliance? Like you said, you send out action alerts. So what are the things that you've been working on?
Yeah, it really depends on the issue. So we cover a wide range of progressive activism issues. Kind of our focused areas are education and libraries, gender equity, LGBT issues, anti-racism work, net neutrality, and youth advocacy. So this a huge range of stuff, basically talking about making a more equitable world for everyone is the summary of that, right?
Right,
so we're working on that. So for example, this past spring, we did an annual Accio Books campaign. That is a book drive, and also partnering with the American Library Association to advocate for libraries. So during that campaign, we raised 8,000 books for Puerto Rico to help them rebuild libraries that were destroyed in the hurricanes, and also donated an additional around 12,000 locally around the world.
Wow.
And then we also had our members making calls to Congress and writing letters to Congress asking them not to cut funding for libraries. So our actions really range from more like service type actions like drives and cleanups all the way to, you know, more advocacy work like making those calls and fighting for policy changes.
Right. So you are involved in fighting for policy and being in the political space.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important distinction, actually, because most people hear 501c3 and, you know, a nonpartisan organization and think that means not political, but that's
right.
Not true. So nonpartisan just means that we don't advocate for any particular party or candidate. It does not mean that we're not political. We're very actively political,
right.
And very open about that. So we are definitely working on policy level changes.
So have you seen a jump in interest since something like the 2016 election or this shifting tide in our political landscape?
Yeah, I think most people, I was very distressed about the 2016 election. It was funny because we were doing a reread of the Harry Potter series that summer.
Mm.
So I was rereading Deathly Hallows as the 2016 election was ramping up, and it was rather chilling to be reading that at the same time. But I think one of the most inspiring things that happened is that immediately after election night, so that week after election night, our start a chapter request spiked. And we had, I think it was 20 to 30 new start a chapter requests that week. And the reasons that people were listing was just obviously, you know, the Death Eaters are in charge now and we need to get to work. So that's been really inspiring to see.
Yeah. I also, I don't know if you track this sort of thing, but do you have more women and girls interested, or is it pretty equal in terms of gender?
We do. Yeah. So our chapter organizers, we have less data on, you know, all of the chapter members out there, but our chapter organizers are about 85% women, and another about 5% trans or non-binary. So our numbers of gender are definitely skewed towards more women and non-binary people. And we're actually about 50% LGBT. So that has been, you know, we were involved in LGBT rights in particular, kind of before it was cool. So at the time, a lot of people were like, ooh, I can't believe like your little nonprofit is taking a stance in like marriage equality. But we've been pretty active in that space for a long time. And so I think that created a really strong community of those folks.
Do you think it skews this way, like skews to these numbers and this sort of demographic because of Harry Potter or because of the nature of fandom or the issues you take on? It's kind of, I guess, a chicken or the egg situation. Like you said, you're 50% yeah. LGBT, so you took, you know, you take on LGBT activism. Or is it right. You had LGBT activism and you attracted LGBT members? Yeah,
I think in that issue, you know, Harry Potter, the fandom has kind of become a very LGBT friendly space from the beginning. So I think that's a little bit maybe kind of a mutual development. That's an interesting question about numbers of women involved. I think part of it is probably the way that we approach fandom. I would say, you know, they talk about how there are different ways people interact with fandom, and women tend to interact on a much more kind of meta-analysis, community-creating right. level. And that's definitely a generalization, but that seems to be the trend. And that's kind of the space that we're usually interacting with.
Right.
I also have to wonder, you know, we are very part of our goal is to sometimes provide what we like to say is a complementary method of activism. Mm-hmm. So a lot of more traditional activism can be very intense and sometimes aggressive, and sometimes I'm a little bit more than folks like to get into. And our method is to make things much more focused on, you know, we say the weapon we have is love, and we are very focused on community building. And I wonder if that more kind of feminine way of approaching activism does kind of have that effect of attracting our feminine folks. But I think, you know, we've also just been a very girl power focused space for a long time.
Right.
So that could be part of it.
So on this question of less aggressive activism and sort of weapon is love, which I love, and I think that's such a tenet of Harry Potter and fandom in general. But do you think, especially in this sort of political climate, do you think that some of the more aggressive activism is more effective? Or you hear a lot about civility these days or kind of softening this rhetoric, where we're kind of in a moment where the rhetoric needs to be very specific and precise and mm-hmm. sharp. So do you think that is at odds with your type of activism?
No, I don't think it's at odds. And I think this is kind of an important distinction for us, because when we're talking about our methods, it's never about, you know, other forms of activism are bad or wrong, right? Mm-hmm. I think we get into this sense, especially in the progressive side of things, I think, where we're kind of looking for what's the ultimate right answer for organizing and what's like the right way to do things. And I don't think there is one. I think that we need kind of a range of different ways to get more folks in the movement. And at the end of the day, that's what's critical for us. So I think right now, that more aggressive organizing, for lack of a better term, is very much needed. You know, there are literal neo-Nazis out and about, and that must be met with that kind of aggressive action. I think that's very clear. But the benefit of having something like the Harry Potter Alliance, that is also very staunchly, you know, hello, there are Nazis and we're not about that, but also working on the getting folks in what can feel like a slightly less aggressive way, and giving folks that space to feel like they can ask questions that maybe they feel like they can't ask in the folks that are kind of on the front lines, that maybe they can't ask these things on the internet because they're afraid of what the response might be, but they genuinely want to learn. So we're really trying to get towards, you know, if you think about the adoption curve, if you haven't seen that, Google it. There will be this curve that comes up of like, you have your early adopters, you have your late majority, and the early adopters are like the folks who are going to go out and join whatever activist organization. And that late majority are like the folks that we will never get them. They're like, cool, racism's fine. That's right. Whatever. But we're looking for that middle part of the curve. Like, we're really trying to attract those folks who they are maybe not allies, but they have not been activated for some reason, right? So we're trying to find a way to kind of get them into the movement so that they can be activated as supporters as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. We say on the show a lot, you know, there are lots of different ways to get involved, and you start with whatever you're comfortable with. And I feel like this is a great way in there. So to that end, in terms of getting people involved and activated, I really like that word, you have something called the Granger Learning Academy?
The Leadership Academy,
Excuse me, the Granger Leadership Academy.
Oh, you're fine. It's learning as well.
Can you tell us about that?
We, a few years ago, were like, you know what? It would be so cool to get folks together and kind of do our version of a leadership conference. So my background is actually in more traditional leadership training programs. I was kind of brought up in college leadership programs. And so I've seen of what that space looks like. And that space is great. Like, I obviously learned a lot from them. But unfortunately, there are a lot of times where, just like some of what we were just talking about in activist movements, you know, there are ways that barriers are intentionally or unintentionally created for folks, and they can feel a little bit like left out of that space, or like that space isn't for them. So we wondered, you know, what would a Harry Potter Alliance version of a leadership conference look like? And that's how the Granger Leadership Academy was kind of conceived. So it's designed to feel like if you had a version of Hogwarts or the Shield Academy or whatever hero training academy you can imagine for our world, that's GLA. There's a storyline that goes along with it. You're in an immersive environment. You're referred to as trainees the entire weekend. So it's really made to feel like you're actually becoming the hero of your own story. And we walk you through the hero's journey as we go throughout the weekend. So we start off really thinking about kind of, who am I as a hero? What's that hero identity? And then leaning more into, all right, what does it look like when you assemble your team and your group? And then getting really deep into social justice training and learning from real grassroots organizers and activists from around the country. So we're about to head into our fifth year of that conference, which is super exciting. Wow. It's coming up this March 21st, 24th in Philadelphia. And it's just been such an amazing experience to see folks who are primarily people who have never been to an event that's even remotely social justice-y or leadership-y. You know, they're really coming from, okay, like, I really love fandom and I really want to do something about making our communities better. And they come to GLA and kind of across the board, everyone is feeling like, you know, their confidence is improved. They leave there feeling like they have the tools to actually go back to their communities and do something. And they leave as part of this network of alumni that is super strong and continues to talk with each other throughout the year. So it's just an amazing community, and I'm super proud and inspired to be part of it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So a couple of questions for you. What house are you in?
I'm a proud Hufflepuff.
I love that. How did you get involved with the Harry Potter Alliance?
I was a chapter organizer. It's funny because when I was working through, you know, all those more traditional leadership programs in college, my focus in school was actually working in youth programs and working in engagement design and figuring out how to make programs interesting for folks. So I heard about the Harry Potter Alliance and I was just like, wow, this is kind of everything I love all together in one place. And I actually, it's a great story. I turned down a position working for a local nonprofit, helping them organize some stuff so that I would have time to run my HPA chapter. And at the time, I got a lot of funny looks. And now I'm like, haha, a joke's on you.
This is what I do now.
Yeah, so I was a chapter organizer for a couple years, and I volunteered for a couple years after that, and then was lucky to join full-time staff.
That's amazing. Each house has its own strengths and challenges. So what have you found? What does each house bring to activism individually? Do you see trends people who...
This is so funny. There's an entire program that our friend Sandra Robinson Burns teaches at GLA about this very subject. So that's the kind of programming you'll get at GLA if you're interested in that. I think every house definitely brings something to the table. Like sometimes in activism, I think we tend to think about a Gryffindor in activism, right? Like we tend to think about the folks who are just kind of going to jump into the fray and go out there and do it. But we also, you know, we need Slytherins. I have to say, as a nonprofit, like sometimes you need Slytherins to figure out how you're going to advocate for yourself. And I've learned a lot from Slytherins about advocating for myself, I think, and advocating for what you believe in. And you need those Ravenclaws to be thinking about, you know, how are we going to craft our story? How are we going to create a message? And, you know, how are we going to organize this spreadsheet behind the scenes? And then I think for Hufflepuff, you know, loyalty is something that everyone thinks about with Hufflepuff, right? And thinks about bringing people into the fold and being loyal to your community. And I really love those values and love the idea that a Hufflepuff is someone who's really caretaking for folks. But especially as I've gotten older, I've also begun to think about that value of loyalty as being loyal to yourself and being loyal to your values and to making sure that you're taken care of as well. So yeah, I think every house is needed, and all houses are great, and they can all be one together. Yeah.
Yes, as a proud Slytherin, I also I'm also an activist.
I have seen so many of the best friendships and relationships are between Hufflepuffs and Slytherins. I think we bring out like the best in each other.
Oh,
you know,
100%. I'm married to a Hufflepuff, so I have very strong feelings about this.
So many times. Talk to someone who's either a Slytherin or a Hufflepuff, and their significant other is the other Hufflepuff.
Yeah. So I'm very committed to that. Well, Janae, thank you so much for joining us. This was a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, of course.
And
for sure.
And you all can follow the Harry Potter Alliance on Twitter at the HP Alliance, and then of course there's the Granger Leadership Academy. So, and Janae, where can we find you online?
You can find me at Janaeisms, Janaeisms, or at Janae.online.
All right. Well, thank you so much again.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. All right, Varsha. So what are you grateful for today?
I am grateful for a story in the Washington Post style section about Kellyanne Conway and her husband, George Conway. And I just the reason I'm grateful for this is because, like, I tried not to engage in schadenfreude, but this is just too good. Right. So
it's too good.
The title of the article is just also just so delicious. It's "She Works for Trump. He Can't Stand Him. This is the life with Kellyanne and George Conway." Like, on a certain level, this is normalizing the fact that Kellyanne has been lying to us for years.
And yes. They're kind of giving her a puffy, like a fluffy puffy.
Yeah, but the thing about it is that the Washington Post, at least the person who wrote this article, Ben Terrace, is like in on the joke, and he knows this is like a really bad puff piece because it's clear that he, or at least the way he conducted this interview, he doesn't want the reader to like love Kellyanne Conway. Specifically grateful for something that's like frankly iconic. Okay, like I have to give Kellyanne props here. She said, so the interviewer asks, "You told me you found George's tweets disrespectful," and Kellyanne responds, "It's disrespectful. It is a violation of basic decency, certainly, if not marital vows." And then she adds, as a person familiar with their relationship. And then the interviewer is like, no, we're on record here. You can't pretend you're on background. And I'm really grateful for the fact that even though Kellyanne has been in the public eye and been on news and been like talking to the press for almost 2 years now or 3 years, she still doesn't know how to go on background and not go on background. And I really think that someday this administration is going to be brought down by a scandal. I mean, there's already so many other scandals, but it's going to be brought down by a really dumb scandal because somebody didn't know they were on the record. As Scaramucci, yeah, like randomly called up a reporter, this is like somehow worse. This article gave me a little bit of joy, just a little bit.
Just, you know what? That's all we're looking for. Just a little bit of joy. I also want to say, again, this goes back to the Dinesh D'Souza mess that I went to. And because I asked everyone also about how you can reconcile Trump's misogynistic and disgusting comments with, you know, voting for him and supporting them. And everyone pointed to, well, you have to look at his actions because he elevates women in his life. Look at his daughter. Look at Kellyanne Conway, the first successful female campaign manager. And I'm just like, oh, honey.
Yeah, so she's successful because she's lied for the past 2 years. I don't know why you'd want to emulate that.
Yeah, right, exactly. So anyway, I'm going to be frank that my gratitude check this week is sort of like a backdoor Hellion, because we originally wanted to make the Hellion of the week all of these women who have been running and winning primaries and basically the wave of badass women going into the midterms. So in particular, Christine Hallquist, who is a transgender woman, wins the primary for governor in Vermont, and she'll be the first openly trans woman to get a major party nomination for a governorship. There was also a former teacher of the year, Jahana Hayes, who won her primary on Tuesday. So basically just all of these women, it's just this huge wave of diversity and women and Black women and trans women who are all standing up, running, and then winning. And honestly, reading these stories is the only thing that gets me through the day sometimes. Like, sometimes I reread old ones when I'm feeling sad. You know, sometimes I go back and reread the article about Danica Rome winning her seat, or I'll go back and read about how 37,000 women have signed up with Emily's List. And these are the stories that get me through the day. And I am so, so grateful, not only for these stories, but for these women who are putting themselves out there, who are doing the work, and who are making real change, and who are going to change the fucking world.
I just want to add one thing. 538 did an analysis of like who the Democratic Party is nominating across all these races, right? And they found out that it's really good to be a woman in 2018. And that just, I'm not saying like, yeah, this has erased all of sexism. Sexism isn't over, unfortunately. But
just like racism,
it's good to
isn't
see
over
some
either.
Statistics on this. Basically, they found that women who run for office and won the nomination, they're winning at a rate of 46%, while men this year are winning at just 23%. This is just in the Democratic Party, right? And that's amazing, right? And they also they have a podcast, and they made the same point that I made a couple of weeks ago, that like while a lot of this has been credited to Trump and is the Trump effect because so many women despise Trump, they also pointed that this could be a Hillary Clinton effect, by even though she lost, by the fact that she went through this and she lost in front of everyone, a bunch of women looked at her and said, no, I can do that. I can stand up too. And I love that.
I think this is a Hillary Clinton.
It really
is. This
is
the Hillary
yeah.
Clinton effect. I think what Trump did was wake people up. But I think what's getting women energized and running and winning is
Hillary Clinton. Not everyone might want to admit it, but I think they realize, oh, okay, she did that. Like, you know, it sucked when she lost, but I can do that too. And I think that's just so important, because I think it's the same thing when it comes to, you know, people who are Muslim who run. Like, now we don't only have like one Muslim woman who's going to be in Congress. We're going to have two. And so it's so fascinating to see that, you know, women are like actually winning. And I don't want us to, but the one caution I would have is I don't want us to get like so excited, just like everyone was so excited after Barack Obama won the presidency, that they're like, oh yeah, sexism is over now. No, it's not over. Until we have like complete equal parity and complete equality in like every single state in every single way, it's not over. So it's we have a lot of work to do, but it's heartening to see. So I love your gratitude check. Okay, Devin, who is our Hellion for the week?
So the Hellion this week is Aretha Franklin. And I hate that we had to wait until she passed to talk about her, because she is a trailblazer, a one-of-a-kind woman, and that's, I guess, trite to say, but I cannot overstate how important this woman was. So not only in the realm of music, which she was very influential in. I mean, no one can sing like Aretha. But I also want to talk about a story that a lot of people don't know about. So when Angela Davis was arrested for being a communist, Aretha Franklin said that she would be willing to put up Angela Davis's bond. She said, quote, whether it's $100,000 or $250,000. And so the courts wouldn't actually release Angela Davis on bond. And Aretha Franklin had said, quote, my daddy, who is Detroit's Reverend C.L. Franklin, says, I don't know what I'm doing. Well, I respect him, of course, but I'm going to stick by my beliefs. Angela Davis must go free. Black people will be free. I've been locked up for disturbing the peace in Detroit. And I know you got to disturb the peace when you can't get no peace. Jail is hell to be in. I'm going to see her free if there is any justice in our courts. Not because I believe in communism, but because she's a black woman and she wants freedom for black people. I have the money. I got it from black people. They've made me financially able to have it. And I want to use it in ways that will help our people.
So
she,
amazing.
She, not only, like I said, was a trailblazer in music and wildly successful as a black woman, but she was also a social justice advocate and put her money, as she said, you know, black people made this financially possible, and she put her money to good use. And I am very emotional about her passing, like so many others. She was so influential to me. And, you know, her songs about, I mean, they were just so radical and feminist. And respect is about demanding respect in your relationship at a time when people weren't talking about that. And on top of everything else, knowing that she was such an advocate for people. Her last performance was actually at an AIDS benefit with Elton John before she retired.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this was a woman who was a force, and she will leave a hole that will probably never be filled again. So Aretha Franklin, an original hellion, rest in power.
Okay, Devin, what are some action items that listeners can do after the show?
I have one for all of y'all today. We didn't talk about the kids at the border, and I promised that I would talk about it on every show until there is a resolution. And I'm not kidding. There were no new egregious stories, which, I mean, that doesn't mean bad shit hasn't happened or that isn't continuing abuses and that there aren't continuing horrors happening to immigrants in this country. But I definitely want to keep this on top of mind. If you can donate to Racist Texas or other organizations that have people on the ground helping immigrants in Texas, in these places where they need the help the most, you know, there are still children who haven't been reunited with their parents. There are still children who are suffering lifelong trauma. And organizations like Racist Texas are instrumental in not fixing this problem, because we can never fix it, but instrumental in helping salvage what we have. I really want to just focus on that. Also, I'm going to do a shout out to Puerto Rico and, you know, the study we talked about and the death toll from Hurricane Maria is still shocking and disgusting and completely unacceptable. So you can donate to the Puerto Rico Relief Fund at unidosporto.com/en. So, Varsha, that is it for us today.
Yay!
Yay! Thank you so much. I also want to thank Janae Phillips, our guest from the Harry Potter Alliance. If you guys want to check them out, they're at the HP Alliance or hpalliance.org. And they also have the Granger Leadership Academy coming up if you need some training in how to be an activist and also want to be like Hermione Granger, which I do. Thank you all for listening. We will be back here on Monday. So have an excellent weekend. Raise some hell and remember to practice compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at _Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere.